It's the 8th of February 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. How does Big Pharma respond to Ben Goldacre's criticisms? Do scientists need convincing of the power of persuasion? What will Sir Tom Blundell be talking about on Darwin Day? And should cyclists demand better infrastructure for bikes because they're not really very good at the moment? But first, before we begin, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us pay all the server bills and all that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. But now let's get on with the show. And there was huge news this week in the medical world when one of the companies that put the big into Big Pharma, GlaxoSmithKline, signed up to an agreement to publish all of their trial data, and not just the stuff that works. Coincidentally, the same night that that happened, there was also a debate at Conway Hall in central London about just this, whether industry should be publishing all of their results. Ben Goldacre and representatives from the industry were all in attendance, and Trent Burton was there to hear what they all had to say. Here's Trent with more.
On Tuesday night, the 5th of February, Conway Hall hosted PharmaBait. Without seeing the spelling, you might suspect it was an evening of large traps loaded with discount cattle feed, but it was instead a debate and series of talks about ethics and transparency in the pharmaceutical industry. The sold-out evening looked at whether transparency should be a legal as well as ethical obligation, and whether the current processes surrounding clinical trials and studies of drugs were morally acceptable, and if not, what changes were needed. The debate presented a wide range of views from the participants. On the panel were Dr. Xavier Luria, an independent pharmaceutical regulator consultant, very keen to point out that the views expressed on the night were his own and not those of the industry at large. And he was joined by Peter Bogard, a life sciences lawyer, who provided an insight into the legal obligations of the industry. Dr. Miran Epstein, who presented a unique plan for dealing with the current problem in research ethics, which we'll get to in a minute. Director of the Association of British Pharmaceutical Industry, Mr. Andrew Powery-Smith, who spoke of the growing role of the ABPI in clinical trial reporting and who would get involved in a few small spot fires with the final member of the panel, Dr. Ben Goldacre, author of Bad Pharma and all-around medical trials publication Crusader. The evening was chaired by Tomorrow's World presenter and science writer Vivian Parry. By happy coincidence, the site set up by Ben Goldacre, amongst others, alltrials.net, had received some groundbreaking and, dare I say, historic news just a few hours before the debate got underway. News Ben went so far as to describe as moving during his presentation. I spoke to him about it afterwards. It's fair to say today's been a fairly momentous day.
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? We started the alltrials.net campaign just a few weeks ago, and we're calling for all trials to be registered, all results to be reported, and clinical study reports for all completed trials. The industry said this was unacceptable, impossible. Of course, the ABPI have tried to smear me desperately for calling for this ever since Bad Pharma came out. But we've already had Medical Research Council welcome ICWIG, the German equivalent of NICE, signing up, the National Rheumatoid Arthritis Society, National Physicians Alliance from the US. And today, extraordinary and genuinely astonishingly, GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, have signed up to the alltrials.net pledge. They're only going to release clinical study reports initially back to 2001, and we've asked for 1990. But even so, I think this is an extraordinary thing. I think it really lays the gauntlet down. The ABPI, who are the UK pharmaceutical industry body, have desperately tried to delay this. They've been pretending that we're asking for individual patient records and that they have to wait for the EMA to talk about that. The EMA, the European Medicines Agency, are talking about something completely different. They're talking about releasing individual patient data sets. We're not asking for that at all. We're asking for clinical study reports. The ABPI know that, and they're just trying to avoid having to make a public statement about this because they know that it's ethically indefensible to refuse to share the results of clinical trials for medicines that patients in the UK and around the world are taking.
So obviously it's brilliant GSK have taken that first step. How do you now, I suppose, police that they actually go through with what they said they're going to do?
Well, we'll watch and we'll ask. I mean, you know, it's very straightforward. We'll be engaging in the kind of routine public audit that regulators should always have done. In fact, it's extraordinary to me that it was left to, you know, a scruffy-haired bloke like me, Sir Ian Chalmers, you know, Sense About Science, editor of the BMJ, and various others to try and address this problem and to push this. I know that people have been working on this for a long time in different places, in different ways, but good grief, it's extraordinary that this hadn't already happened, really.
Are you surprised how, I mean, Bad Farm's been out, what, 4 months? Are you surprised how quick it seems to have happened? The public interest has gone through the roof now. GSK have signed up after like a week of all trials, essentially.
Well, look, I mean, you know, when Bad Pharma first came out, the ABPI, the UK pharmaceutical industry body, sent round sort of odd smear mail saying I was a fringe maverick. They said, I had it out actually because I was reading it to somebody from the ABPI. They say, we made a decision not to engage with him. And this is at the same time they were pretending they were. They said, to engage directly only serves to perpetuate the misleading views he projects. The ABPI, like most of those involved in healthcare in the UK and the rest of the world, believes his views to be misleading, inflammatory and inaccurate. We then blah, 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 all this horrid sort of very silly personal stuff, the kind of thing that you get off anti-vaccination conspiracy theorists and quacks. And today, they're standing up saying, oh, these are really important issues. We're really glad that they were raised. It's very, very odd. It is very, very odd. My view is you cannot justify withholding the results of clinical trials from patients who take those medicines. And the industry's best hope was obscurity. Their best hope was that nobody would know about this and nobody would talk about it. That's what they were counting on. They wanted to undermine the credibility of me and others when we raised this with policymakers and everywhere. And it's clear that that strategy has failed. I think it's failed because we're right and they're wrong. You know, organisations like the ABPI, who seek to defend the status quo where information about clinical trials is withheld from doctors and patients, they're on the wrong side of history. As soon as the public have this problem clearly explained to them, they know that it's absurd. And I think, you know, I used to play a game with other junior doctors where we'd wonder what is the thing from contemporary medicine today that will turn out to be regarded like bloodletting, right? Like, what's the thing we do today where people look back from in the future and go, what on earth were you thinking? And it's undoubtedly this. It's clinical trials being withheld from decision makers. You go to all this effort to do evidence-based medicine, to do clinical trials, and to find out often very modest differences between two drugs, and then you allow half of the trials to be erased from the academic record. I mean, it's utterly, utterly ridiculous that ever happened. And it will stop. It's a question of how fast. And the people who stand in its way will be judged very, very harshly by history.
How much pressure does that put on people like Roche? You know, you say that they're now well and truly in the minority.
Well, they certainly are. I mean, you know, the eccentric, weird, outsider position now is not signing up to alltrials.net. We've got the Medical Research Council, the Wellcome Trust. We've got the German equivalent of NICE. We've got GSK, you know, patient groups. It's the Royal Statistical Society. You know, it's only bizarre now that anybody would think it's okay not to, right? Who on earth is going to seriously defend withholding clinical trial results from doctors and patients? It was always an insane position to try and defend. The only thing they could ever hope for was that nobody knew about it.
Ben quizzed the director of the ABPI about his reluctance in the debate, only to be again told of their concerns over patient confidentiality. Ben then rattled off quick solutions to removing this information, including the highly scientific notion of a large black marker, before the chair moved the debate along to a statement of overwhelming support from Dr. Ian Chalmers, co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, who was in attendance. His support was echoed by panellist Dr. Xavier Luria when I spoke to him beforehand.
Well, tonight we are going to debate about this clinical trial data access, which is a very relatively controversial issue today. And the first thing that I can anticipate, just to remember how few years ago we were not talking about that particular issue, but only for regulators to get all clinical trials. This means that this has been a tremendous change over a relatively short period of time, and now the debate is concentrated on this area.
So now GSK are sort of on board. What's the next big step in getting all trials published?
There are different initiatives worldwide. One of them is in Europe with a number of groups organized by the European Medicines Agency in order to, let's say, to go ahead on this project of publishing or making publicly available whatever is the way to get the clinical trial data. And all the stakeholders are involved on this project, and I think that this will be a positive thing in the future.
So whilst everyone on the panel and in attendance largely agreed that change was needed, not everyone agreed on the sort of change. Dr. Miriam Epstein had a slightly more radical approach when I spoke to him.
I have a slightly or actually significantly different view than the others. I don't really think that the problem is a problem of regulation or misregulation. I don't think that the world would be nicer or significantly nicer if the trials are published or not. I think we have a basic essential problem with a pharmaceutical industry that is driven by profit instead of needs.
If the drug companies are funding these trials, it should be up to them whether they publish them. It's essentially their property.
No, I think it's part of the corruption. I think that a private property should stop before life, before human life. And the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, is problematic because it is about private property. When it comes to health, private property should be out of the game, I think.
So what do you think is a step in the right direction? Obviously,
I'll say it very bluntly. It's nationalizing the pharmaceutical industry, full stop.
But would you say there is a chance of that actually happening?
I think there's 100% chance, or almost 100% chance, that it will happen. Perhaps not very soon, but I think that the rage against the industry and against a medicine that is complicit with the industry and actually an addict thereof is increasing to levels that make the system really unsustainable, not for much longer, I think. So I'm a little bit more optimistic. I don't expect the private sector to make any concessions here. On the contrary, it will have to come from the people themselves.
Most of the panel felt nationalisation was not only impractical as a solution, but also unnecessary and borderline impossible. But it was hard to argue with Dr. Epstein's passion, and you had to reward him for thinking well outside the box. What all were in agreement with, however, was the general sentiment that pharma companies and doctors alike needed to get back to a place where the patient came first, and GSK's commitment to the All Trials Scheme was a huge step in that direction in providing all available information, albeit just from 2001 onwards at this stage, to doctors and patients. One thing that was clear is that there is not just a logical and moral obligation that this data be available to the people administering and, more importantly, taking these drugs, but now the public is more aware than ever before and are growing increasingly concerned about the scale of the problem. From increased media coverage to the simple fact that 400-odd people would pack out a hall on a cold and wet Tuesday evening to hear about it, the time for change is now, if I were to get all campaign speechy about it. I spoke about this with Chair Vivian Parry straight after the debate ended.
There is a moment in time. The tide has turned, I think, and several people made the point that we will look back in the future and say that those people who argued against transparency will be shown to have been on the wrong side of the argument. And I think that that's true. Although, of course, as a chairman of this debate, I had to remain rather more neutral.
Obviously, you've been covering this sort of debate for quite a while now. What do you think has kind of stimulated it to move so quickly as it has done in sort of the last 6 months?
I think Ben has hit the crest of a wave. I think all of this has been rumbling around for a long time. And I think what Ben has done is kind of bring it to a point where it's burst and it's so visible to people. And I think that people want change.
And what's the next step, I suppose, in keeping the public still engaged? Rather, now everyone's gone, oh yes, this is a problem. How do we now get Joe on the street to act on the outrage, I suppose?
I think it's fine to be outraged, but I think the outrage has to be controlled, because we mustn't forget that actually the pharmaceutical industry brings us new medicines that are vital. So, for instance, think of a drug like Herceptin. Now, that's made a big difference in breast cancers of a particular type. So we need to have a vibrant and innovative pharmaceutical business. But I think we do have to review the way that they operate. And I myself don't believe that actually the solution is always more regulation. I think actually that's one of the reasons that sometimes companies hide things, is because everything is so involved and so lengthy and so costly that they would rather just go away in secret and do things that we don't know about. So I think that we must be tempered in the way that we approach this, because to cut off our supply of medicines would be very foolish.
All proceeds from the evening went to the Census charity, and you can sign up to support the publication of All Clinical Trials yourself at alltrials.net. This has been Trent Burton for The Pod Delusion.
Now, is it ethical for scientists to use persuasive rhetorical techniques to advance their message? My dead grandmother, who gave a lot to charity and really liked kittens, thought that it was fine. But Helen Sersky, who you may know from TV science documentaries, isn't so sure, and at an event next week is convening a panel to debate this. To find out more, Liz and Helen went to the pub.
So you're doing a debate with Marcus Brigstock and others about the science and the dark art of persuasion. Why is persuasion a dark art, and can it be used for good?
Persuasion is a human thing, right? And it's interesting because the ancient Greeks knew about persuasion and rhetoric, and they, in the first democracy, the skill you had to have was to convince others. And so it was a valued skill to have. So right back at the birth of something we think of as fundamental to our society, this issue of rhetoric and persuasion was there. But now it's interesting, because we like to think that we live in a world that we control, and we don't like the feeling of being manipulated. And we are all the time. There are, you know, adverts, marketing campaigns, all these little things are manipulating how we think. So I don't think we mind persuasion when we know that someone's trying to persuade us. But I think a lot of people are kind of uncomfortable when they feel they've been manipulated without knowing about it. And so it's not that I think persuasion is a bad thing. I think it's a human thing. But I think that you have to be careful in how you use it, and you have to be honest about when it's being used. And that means there's a lot of blurring the boundaries. And now this is an important issue in science, because there is a big grey area. We think of ourselves as scientists as being, you know, we collect evidence, we come up with our best judgments on how things work, and those come out with a set of probabilities, and you can say that's our job. But increasingly, the outputs of science influence society, and society wants to know, what should we do? And that means the scientists are talking about their science. And then there are other interests. There are economic and social interests and business interests. And they are absolutely openly out to persuade. And they are going to use every single technique, persuasive technique, going And the scientists are over here in the corner with a probability and a fact, right? And this, and now scientists are starting to have to sell themselves. In the past, maybe this wasn't an issue because there's actually, well, there's two separate issues. There's how you present science, individual bits of science, for example, like what the climate might do. It's how you present that to society. And then scientists have to justify their funding now. They are being told they need to persuade. And then what happens to all their integrity, right? And probabilistic judgments, because they have, you know, a lab that they think is worthwhile, they have a job that they think is important, and they're not just allowed to do it, they have to persuade someone. Now, it's not that that's a bad thing, but then you get into this murky area of what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable.
Leading on from that, there's, you always hear about, and especially with my work, actually, there's the culture change, and, you know, you're trying to persuade a culture change within a company or in an institution. Are these the same kind of techniques then? We're just using them for different purposes?
A lot of them are things that humans do naturally, but they don't know they're doing. And the science on this is still developing. And one of the reasons, actually, that I wanted to run this event is that I don't know. I feel that I'm a scientist and I want to know about this stuff, and I feel I should know about this stuff. And so, and I know some of the things. I know, for example, that if you present something to someone and it has associations with other things that they like, they're more likely to believe in it, right? So I know about some basic things, but I don't know about the whole spectrum of persuasive techniques that are available. And I'm sure, they're very subtle things, but when you're talking about massive, great big issues that really matter to society, you need to understand those subtleties.
So you kind of mentioned that you don't know the whole rest, but what kind of science is done in this area, from neuroscience or just, behavior kind of sociological things? Where is the breadth of science? Where are the edges?
I set out, when I first wanted to do this panel event, I set out to find, to populate the panel with people who might be somewhere in that group. And so we have a cognitive scientist, Bruce Hood. We have an expert in rhetoric. And so that's the ancient art of persuasion. That's Felicity Meller. And we have an expert in philosophy and ethics, which is Barry Smith. And so I think those three areas, the cognition science, how human brains respond, the basic human knowledge that you didn't need science, humans know about persuasion, so I think that's important. And then you have this issue of what's ethical and what isn't ethical, and what's the philosophical implications of scientists doing all this. So there's a lot of science out there, but there's also just a lot of knowledge from before. Humans have been trying to persuade each other, we should pay attention to that and use that. So I think one of the reasons that this debate probably hasn't happened is that there is no one simple group. There's a huge range of different opinions that matter. And the point of doing this as a debate and having hopefully a very wide audience there is that we get all those different perspectives. I'm sure there are perspectives out there that I haven't thought of, and I want to hear from them. And so the point about your question is I don't know the answer, and that's why we're having this debate. Yes.
So should climate scientists be learning, NLP? Should they be doing like weird shoulder taps and all that sort of neuro-linguistic programming?
Oh, yeah. this is the point, isn't it? There's two issues here, and they are separate. And one of them is that scientists should know what is being used against them. So if a scientist stands up in a public debate and says their bit of science, and then someone else stands up and gives an example using a kitten, the scientists should be aware that that anecdote about the kitten is going to be far more powerful than all their data and statistics, right? So the first thing is being aware of the tools that are being used against in those public debates. And then you get to the much more interesting issue, which is it ever justified for a scientist to use those themselves? And this is the slippery slope, because you write to persuade. You do that. You have to do that. We're human. But how much is it justified? If I am in a debate, with a climate skeptic, for example, and they have a story about someone's grandmother, which is the other, it's kittens and grandmothers, basically, that's how you appeal to people. And they have some anecdotes about a grandmother and some issue, which supports their side of the story. Am I ever justified in using an anecdote in return? Am I ever justified in, telling a story which leads to my point of view? which ones of these techniques are available to me? Are none of them? Because it's easy just to say, well, scientists are above all of that. The thing we have is integrity. So we should just do our job, produce our numbers, and let the world get on with it. That's not our problem, right? The problem is that scientists are some of the most qualified people to interpret those numbers, and it's this interpretation that becomes very difficult. And if a climate scientist... So the climate science debate is very interesting when it comes to this, because it's a thing where if you say anything that isn't absolutely true, you get shot down very, very quickly. So climate scientists have been able to have a lot of integrity, because if they say anything else, it will get shot down, even though the other side are using all those techniques all the time. But if I believed, you know, the question is, if I was, I don't know, in front of some parliamentary committee or some decision-making body, and I had a piece of science that I thought predicted with 95% certainty that a certain thing was true, and against me is arguing someone who's using a lot of stories and a lot of anecdotes, and, you know, personality, all these things that persuade people, and I really care about this issue, you know, it might be vaccination or it might be some medical or climate issue, really important. So I believe in my science. Am I ever justified in saying this is so important that I can tell a story or an anecdote or use more manipulative techniques in order to persuade? And so I think the thing here is that I don't want science to sleepwalk into these issues where we compromise our integrity when we shouldn't. Because unless you have the debate, what will happen is that the most persuasive people will win. They may damage the reputation of science, and the rest of us will have to pick up the pieces. We need to have a debate so we can set those boundaries and say this is what is acceptable to do. We need to, I think all scientists need to be far more aware of this, and we need to have an ethical debate about what is acceptable in different situations, not because it will provide answers, but because it will set the framework for the question in each individual circumstance.
So in your debate, will your arguments be drawing on the time that your grandmother had an argument about climate change?
That might be giving away how I'm going to start the debate.
So to bring it all back to the beginning, I guess, when is the RI debate and how can people get tickets, as it were?
The RI debate is at the Royal Institution on the 12th of February. It starts at 7:30 in the evening, I think. And tickets are available on the Royal Institution website. I think they're £10 each. And we've got a really varied audience, and I think it's going to be a fascinating debate, and everybody who goes is going to learn something from it.
The RI been in the news recently for having a little bit of financial difficulty. I mean, what's your take on the whole thing? We've covered sort of both sides of the arguments on our show.
I think the building is important. We're human beings, and just if people can't, part of the problem with this debate, I think, is that people have gone, oh, we're scientists, we're rational, of course we don't care about buildings. Buildings matter to people. That's part of the persuasion thing. Standing in the Faraday Lecture Theatre, where Faraday stood and did these demonstrations, that's a human. You're touching history, right? You're touching your culture. And I think to let that go would be a terrible shame. And it sounds as though it's unlikely, very unlikely, that the RI will actually be sold, and it's a good time to have a debate. But the building is so valuable as a cultural reference point that I can't see it ever actually being lost.
Lovely.
We'll put links to buy tickets to the debate on the dark art of persuasion on the Podillusion website. Helen Zdursky, thank you very much.
Check out our website on Monday to hear a longer cut of the interview where Liz talks to Helen about her work on TV and researching bubbles. Now, next Tuesday is the British Humanist Association's annual Darwin Day lecture, which, as ever, will be chaired by Richard Dawkins. The main speaker this year, though, is Sir Tom Blundell, the pioneering biochemist who works at the University of Cambridge. He's going to be talking about the emergence of drug resistance, molecular evolution, and new medicines for cancer and tuberculosis. Sounds like a big topic. I mean, metaphorically, as molecules are tiny. So to find out more about the man and his work, Andrew Holding met Sir Tom and had a word.
I'm Andrew Holding, and today I am joined by Sir Tom Blundell in the Department of Biochemistry in Cambridge. Tom, thank you for agreeing to talk to me today. I thought we would just start by asking, when you were back at school, did you ever think that you'd be spending a lifetime career in science?
Never. I tried to be an artist like my grandfather. I ran a modern jazz group, but I was no good at that. And I ended up in politics and science at Oxford, and eventually decided that science was most enjoyable and I was probably better at it.
Well, you've obviously gone on to do very well in, as a scientific career. You're obviously now a fellow of the Royal Society. You were knighted in 1997. Your field of structural biology, something which I worked with you on in the past, or at least members of your group, is there anything that particularly drew you to that field?
I thought that science should be beautiful, and I found that the architecture of the sort of subcellular organization of proteins was beautiful. I worked on insulin with Dorothy Hodgkin in the 60s, and we had this marvelous hexameric molecule that looked just like Chartres Cathedral. And I thought, well, it's going to be a really, really interesting but really beautiful subject. And that's when I found it.
One thing which, of course, is quite important now, and it's facing all fields, is the fact that money is tight. Have you been particularly involved in trying to encourage funding from science research?
Of course. I'm chairman of a research council, and of course, the present system of research councils in the UK, I was very much involved in rearranging. So 20 years ago, I became the first chief executive of the new BBSRC. And after being out of it for a long time, nearly two decades, I came back as chair. And at the moment, I've spent a lot of time really trying to convince government that unless they create an infrastructure for high technology science, they won't have a high technology industry, and they won't have growth and jobs. And one thing that I'm particularly interested in is the relationship between large companies, the small ones of the sort that I founded myself, the academic labs, and in my area, the clinical trials. And what I believe very, very strongly is that unless we get the interaction between the government-funded infrastructure for science, the venture capital and other funded small companies, the large companies, which are global institutions, to come here and to have first-rate clinical trials, then none of those four will exist. They're all interdependent, and they comprise one area where we're very good in the UK and we need to sustain activity.
One thing I know you've been involved in also is discussions involving education in schools. Do you think that science education is something that's also crucial to this?
Well, of course. I've not done as much as I would like to in schools. Of course, I've been and done lectures for sixth formers and sometimes younger children. I believe that a lot of people don't make up their mind as young as is assumed. The general view is that a choice between science and arts is taken between 11 and 14. I certainly didn't make up my mind until much later than that. But I do think that it's important to remember that science isn't just a linear process of problem solving. In fact, people are good problem solving. Solvers are really important. But you do need people who have a sort of broader lateral thinking, because part of science is identifying what it is you can do with the knowledge you have. And it's sometimes a little bit outside where you are at the moment. And so I think that idea of using analogy, of having ideas, is as important as having an ability to solve problems in a linear fashion.
So obviously we're talking today because you're doing the Darwin Lecture for the British Humanist Association. I mean, I suppose it seems only natural that having been political, having been a scientist, that you would end up involved in something like the humanists. But what was it that actually drew you towards it?
Well, I guess it was one of my school teachers at the age of 15 who made the mistake of trying to convince me that religion had a scientific basis. It was the most appalling attempt at an argument, but he was a very lovable guy, and I've kept in touch with him until he died, actually. But it convinced me that that the whole story of the religion I was brought up in, which was obviously Christianity, really had no convincing basis. But nevertheless, I became very much aware that in all of us is a willingness to, and a wish to collaborate, to interact, to love, and that putting those two together, I found a meaning in life which others told me I could only find in religion. It's certainly not a religion, but it's certainly a recognition that it's up to us to decide how we're going to live and interact. And I just believe that, on the whole, the human race has been selected not for individuals, but for the way the individuals interact in communities, which gives a selective advantage.
So that leads us on, obviously, to what are you going to be talking about in your lecture?
Well, I'm going to address this question, which many people have asked me, because I often give lectures on evolution. It's evolution of proteins. And people say, well, are you sure? And 40, 50 years ago, I would say, as I looked at the first data of sequences for diverging insulins, I would say, well, they're consistent with a common ancestor. And that was certainly the case. But could I test the hypothesis that they were? And it's difficult to do over long periods of time, although one can make a hypothesis about evolution and predict things about the rate of change in parts of the genome which we've not really studied before. But what is quite fantastic is that the rate of evolutionary change in, as I said earlier, in pathogens and in tumours is just huge. And also with modern sequencing, we can get many, many looks at an evolving pathogen or an evolving tumour cell. And already in TB, I've just been out in India and talking with the Indian coordinators of their open source drug discovery program. And there, of course, they're collecting together all the strains of TB and analysing them. We're doing similar things in the Gates program and in a European program. And then on the other side, in cancer, I work quite closely as deputy chair of the trustees of the Institute of Cancer Research. And there we're looking at the opportunities to understand the disease by taking the tumours out of people in Marsden Hospital who come with cancer and really trying to understand how the sequences of the tumours change as they grow and metastasize, and then trying to advise how that would indicate which were the most successful drugs. But it's quite clear from looking at many of the changes that I see coming up in the emerging sequences, and we're going to have a lot more data, that quite a lot of the fixed mutations in these cancers are a result of drug resistance. And so on the one hand, you get an example of evolution changing the tumour. It's convincing that evolution is occurring, but also it's useful to know that because we can now design against mutations that occur frequently. And that's, I think, going to be very important. There's some examples in cancer already, and there are also examples in the TB area.
Well, thank you for your time today. It's been great speaking to you, and all the best of luck for your talk.
Thank you very much.
Now, Joe Dunkley is a member of a revolutionary movement, by which I mean he rides a bike. I know, that's quite a tired pun. But hey, you're saddled with it. But that's what happens when you let me frame a segment and put me on the pedal still. That sort of works. I bet you didn't think these weak bike references could get any worse, but then I guess you spoke too soon. I bet you're wishing that I'd give you a break or perhaps change gear. I guess I've really derailleured this conversation now. A derailleur is an assembly of levers, usually cable-actuated, that moves the chain between sprockets on a cassette or chainring assembly, apparently. That's why that almost works as a pun. Anyway, this week Joe has been speaking to transport sociologist Rachel Aldred about how we could improve transport infrastructure to make things better for cyclists.
So I'm here at the University of Westminster with senior lecturer in transport, Rachel Aldred. So you're an academic researching cycling, and surely cycling, it's as easy as riding a bike. Why does this need to be researched? What is being researched when you're looking at cycling?
Sure, yes, I've been asked that before. In fact, in my very first radio interview I did related to the Cycling Cultures Project, where I was a bit thrown to be asked, shouldn't they just spend the money on potholes instead? And one answer that I was given was actually last night when I was doing a Street Talks presentation, and somebody in the audience there speaking to me afterwards said, well, the kind of things you were saying, we've all felt this, but it's actually quite helpful to have an academic saying it with references. So that is one reason why research is useful, that even sometimes it tells you things that people thought they knew. It's useful to have the evidence, it's useful to have that corroborated, and sometimes hopefully research tells you things you didn't know. I mean, research has changed my mind, doing research has changed other people's minds, so hopefully there's those two possibilities, but either way it can be very useful, I think.
So you've recently conducted this project on cycling cultures. What have you discovered that's new here or that's important to know here?
Well, the idea behind the project was partly to look at places where cycling levels were relatively high and or rising in a UK context, given that cycling is generally pretty low in this country, and to try and find out what insights we could learn from those places, what was going on in those places, what made cycling work better in those places, and what barriers there still were to cycling. And one finding was that cycling was still very problematic in a lot of ways in those four areas. So, for example, media representations of cycling locally were, not in all cases, but in some cases, still pretty negative. People still had to battle with a lot of stigmas, a lot of associations of cycling with lycra louts, with incompetence, with lack of income, and so on, all these different, often conflicting representations. And also, in many of these places, the environments for cycling were kind of mixed. They were not necessarily that great. But one of the hopeful things that came out of the project that, for me, was a bit of a surprise was all the ideas that people had about making cycling better. People were drawing conclusions about their experience of cycling rather than saying, well, it's an individual choice that some people do, some people don't do. And I think, when I'm being hopeful, that means that maybe our thinking about cycling is changing away from it being an individual lifestyle thing to being something more like a system or a service that ought to be provided, and that if it's not being provided or it's being provided badly, something ought to be done about it.
So I think that brings us to what is currently going on in Parliament, where the cross-party cycling group are holding an inquiry that has come out of all sorts of lobbying and campaigning.
Yep.
And it's called Get Britain Cycling. So why isn't Britain cycling, and how can we get them cycling?
The important thing is providing a really good cycling environment. That's something that Britain has failed at on a whole range of fronts. Perhaps the most obvious and the thing that's one of the most important to start with is the physical infrastructure, the physical environment for cycling, but also there's a whole load of other things like the cultural environment for cycling, where the cyclists are welcomed, where the cycling is seen as a normal thing to do, the legal environment and so on. But traditionally in Britain, we've had this approach to providing for cycling that creates what I've described as a hierarchy of cyclists. So you have in the guidance notes in Local Transport Note 208, which is called Designing Cycle Infrastructure Design, there's a discussion of how you provide for cyclists, and there's a list of cyclists, different categories of cyclists. The fast commuters at the top, and children are lower down, and at the bottom is users of specialised equipment. And the idea is that you provide different types of things for those different types of cyclists, which sounds quite nice if you're overall providing a high quality system. But given the fact that in this country cycling has always been a poor relation, we've always spent very little on cycling, and we've always fitted it into the gaps beside motor vehicle provision, what that's ended up meaning has been that, okay, if you're somebody who likes to ride fast and get to work quickly, you have to deal with cycling on the road with lots of motor traffic. If you're someone who's a bit less confident with that, if you're somebody who doesn't want to do that, then you have to put up with taking the circuitous route. So we've provided these two alternatives that are often not very good and that don't necessarily even please either group, let alone all the other people who might like to cycle. So what for me is a hopeful sign emerging from some places in the UK, potentially starting to emerge in London, is the idea that you have more of a universal design. I mean, that the idea of universal design or universal services is not unusual in other areas. The idea that you don't provide special services for some groups, you try and provide something that's accessible to everyone as far as possible. And that idea, I think, is starting to make headway a little bit in cycle provision. I think that will be really important. And we have to make cycling easy, and we have to make it comfortable as well as safe, and all those things should fit together and should mean that the everyday person will be able to cycle, not just somebody, you know, perhaps like me and some people listening who can get their head around reading a cycle map, who know what panniers are and so on. It has to be available to everyone.
So the whole system has to be changed. It's not just one quick and simple thing that Boris Johnson can do on a very small budget.
It'll take money. It'll take money, but if you look at how much Crossrail costs, I think $16 billion, but it will really be a lot more than that. I mean, and if you look at the Highways Agency's budget, the public transport budget, and so on, and not even going into all the non-transport things that we waste money on. I think I worked out through the scientific process of multiplying £20 per person per year by the number of people living in England outside London that you would need around about £1 billion a year to spend sort of Dutch-ish levels on cycling in this country. So £1 billion for England apart from London on a yearly basis. And really, I think it should be more than that because we're behind, so we need to catch up. It needs to be funded as a proper transport mode, and it needs to be not something that has a Minister for Sustainable Transport. So you have somebody who's talking for real transport and you have somebody who's talking for sustainable transport. You know, it has to be built in.
So your current research now is looking at the use of modelling in developing transport policy, is that right?
Yeah.
And so looking at, in particular, some of the ways that modelling has been rather misused, perhaps.
Yep, I'm coming at this from a social science angle, so I'm not somebody who has specific expertise in transport modelling, but it's something that became obvious it was really important. So, for example, from a local campaigner perspective, you would often hear people saying, oh, we're told that we can't do such and such because the model says that this will lead to congestion, or this will lead to consequences that we can't, that won't be acceptable. But also there seem to be some really interesting things going on inside modelling. So the work of, for example, people like David Bannister, who've been involved in modelling scenarios. So that rather than, because often with modelling, one looks at the impact of a relatively small change. So it might be a small infrastructural change, it might be a small policy change, and then you look forward and say, what will the result of that be? So David Bannister's work has been looking at, well, there are these different possible worlds we might live in. You know, what would those worlds be like and how might we get there? And for me as a sociologist, that's really interesting. And it's also potentially much more radical because you're saying, you're looking at, okay, for example, it's climate targets. We want to meet these climate targets. How on earth can we get to a world where we meet these climate targets? And it actually allows you to think a lot more differently than just looking at small incremental policy changes. The other thing that's interesting about modelling is, well, one other thing is that health people have got very interested in transport and have got very interested in looking at transport modelling, and also, and they've been bringing in stuff around health as well, so health benefits of different transport modes. And when you bring that in and you look at the physical activity benefits of people walking and cycling, then the figures just go, like, start skyrocketing, because a lot of the disease burden in countries like the UK is to do with physical inactivity and obesity and so on. So there's also some interesting stuff coming in around that. So potentially some of these developments challenge traditional approaches to transport modelling, which tend often to have an engineering or an economics focus. So the engineering focus is very much around the sort of, you know, congestion, traffic junctions and so on, and working out whether taking away a lane of motor traffic will lead to greater congestion. There's also the approach that's more economics based, where you basically are looking at how people choose to travel, and you're saying, okay, people make a rational choice in the morning. They get up in the morning, they think, oh, car, bus, tube, train, walk, cycle, or whatever, and they do a little calculation and they choose their particular transport mode based on that calculation. So that is a sort of traditional approach to thinking about how people make decisions about journeys. So for me, coming from a social science background, again, I would criticise that kind of utility maximising view and the idea that people act in isolation, they're making this rational choice about travelling. So sort of trying to bring other perspectives in as well, trying to think about travel behaviour a little bit differently.
Okay, Dr. Rachel Aldred, thank you very much. I've been Joe Dunkley for the Pod Delusion.
Now, over the last few years, it's been very trendy to hate on the bankers. I know, right? Just because they very nearly destroyed the world economy, some people think that it's a carte blanche excuse to call them incompetent and terrible. This week, Marxist revolutionary Sean Ellis is going to add to the chorus by criticising the way banks handle moving between bank accounts. Here's Sean with more.
Have you ever tried to change your bank account? I have, and I didn't like it one bit. It seems like our Chancellor, George Osborne, doesn't like it either. So this week, he came up with the pledge that he would force the banks to transfer accounts within 1 week. Now, this is exactly the same pledge that my current bank made to me when I switched to them several years ago, and I suspect it will be honoured in exactly the same spirit, i.e. not at all. In reality, the bank sends out automated messages to anyone taking direct debits, informing them of the change in account number. This may only take 5 days, but the general incompetence of the receivers of this information mean that the actual time to sort out the problems wasn't 5 days, but 10 months. And that's just direct debits. I still had to fiddle around with payroll, credit cards, child benefit payments, and miscellaneous other people who all needed to know my new details. So, here's an alternative proposal that, when it is inevitably adopted, should make the process so much more streamlined. Luckily for me, I don't have to think of an analogy, as another sector has already done something very similar. In the bad old days, if you wanted to move house, you had to change your phone number. The number you dialed was the actual physical address of your phone line. It actually moved the switches to connect your bit of wire directly with the bit of wire at the caller's end. With the advent of digital exchanges, all of that changed. Your phone number is now just a kind of external label. The number of the actual line you connect to is stored internally and is completely separate. That means that you can change your physical line number by moving house without having to change the actual number dialed. From day one, digital cellular phone services also adopted this same model. The number you dial is not the unique identifying number for your actual phone. That's stored on your SIM card. Again, you can change phones without having to change your telephone number. So, why can't we do this with bank accounts? The banks were the first large institutions to take advantage of information technology. They should have been the first to realise the power of divorcing your external account number from the internals of where your money is actually stored. So, how should this work? At present, we have a 6-digit sort code, which tells you what bank it's in, and an 8-digit account number, which tells you which clerk's desk your box is stored under. We can keep this as an internal representation. After all, it does tell you exactly where your money actually is. Let's add a few zeros on to allow for further expansion. Double the size if necessary. It's not a number that humans will have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. For the external representation, we create a new unified account number. To start with, the easiest way is to take the existing sort code and account number, munge them together, add some extra zeros again, and give you that as your new number. This need never change unless you want it to. People are already used to 16-digit numbers as credit card numbers, so why not adopt that format for account numbers too? So, let's take a concrete example. Imagine Mr. John Q. Average, who has an account at Megabank, sort code 112233, account number 12345678. Actually, that's a right pain to read out. So let's make it a bit easier. Let's say his sort code is 3 and his account number is 12. Obviously, what you'll need to do is to substitute those for enormously long numbers in your head while you're listening to this. Anyway, at the start, we try and make the transition as easy as possible. So we base the new numbers on his old account number. So his new external account number is, say, 0312. For his physical account, MegaSave Bank, sort code 3, assigns him a new, completely arbitrary internal account number. Let's say 77. So the complete thing is 377. In reality, this would be a 20-digit number, but that's okay because it's only the computers that will ever really see it. Meanwhile, Mr. Average, with his new account number 0312, is based on the old sort code and account number, but the sort code isn't separate anymore and it no longer means anything. At the clearinghouse, there's a simple lookup table that associates the external number 0312 and the internal sort code and account number 377. These are two key numbers that are now associated with each other. Every month, his wages are paid by his employer, who only has his external account number. At the clearinghouse, they take that number, 0312, and look up the actual physical account number, 377, and transfer to that account. The same process happens when he transfers cash, pays a direct debit, honours a standing order, or, shock horror, uses a cheque. A couple of months down the line, the shoddy service at Megabank makes Mr. Average want to change to use FriendlySave instead. Fine. He goes to FriendlySave, sort code 4, and opens an account using an account transfer form. Obviously, he has to supply adequate ID to ensure that he is who he says he is and not a money launderer or murderer or something. And he gets a new physical account number at FriendlySave, say 488, which identifies his account slot at FriendlySave. At some point, after adequate confidence has been achieved with his identification and so on, the clearinghouse receives a transfer order requesting a transfer of all assets from the existing physical account attached to his external account number, and at the same time the reassignment of his internal account number. So this is an atomic operation. It should not be possible to connect a debit or payment to an inactive account. So the clearinghouse now has the external account number 0312 as before, but it's now associated with the new FriendlySave physical account 488. That's where his wages now go, that's where his bills are paid from, and that's where FriendlySave make their money. No need for anyone except Megabank and FriendlySave to even know this has happened. So, how about it, High Street Banks? What's the problem? By adopting an internal-external ID scheme, this change would have to happen at just one place, the central clearinghouse. And just as there's no need to mail all your friends to let them know you have a new mobile phone, there would be absolutely zero need to mail anybody to let them know you have a new bank account. And maybe that's the rub. The banks like to advertise how easy the process of changing is, but we all know that the actual time to sort out the whole thing is many times longer than they claim, and much more hassle. And customers are thus discouraged from changing accounts. Just imagine what life would be like if you really could change your account with no hassle. Your bank annoying you? Just change. This probably sounds good if you're a customer, but also probably doesn't sound too good if you're a large monopoly bank with poor customer service, does it? This is Sean Ellis, living in hope for unified portable banking for the Pod Delusion.
Now before we go, a quick plug for this year's Skeptic magazine Occam Awards, in which last year we won the Best Podcast Award. Nominations are open again, so the other day I had a quick chat with Skeptic magazine editor Deborah Hyde to find out what they're all about. The Occam Awards are back this year. What's going on?
Well, at the moment, we're asking for people to vote on the website for their favourite top five. Actually, for their favourite one, and then we'll choose the top five, and it will go on to the judges afterwards.
Top five blogs?
The top five blogs, the top five podcasts, and the top five campaign event outreach type events. That would be the kind of things like Robin Ince won it last year, for example, or the 1023 campaign would qualify, or the Nightingale campaign. That kind of thing. Something that's happened in 2012, in the last 10 months, that's really made a difference in scepticism.
Excellent. And when's the award ceremony going to be this year?
We are really, really lucky. Again, we're going to be able to present these awards at QED, which is happening in April in Manchester. And it was fantastic last year, such a brilliant vibe. Everybody was there on the Saturday evening. Richard Wiseman emceed the event. We had all of the various guests and people who were there awarding them. It was a really nice feeling.
No, I was really pleased to see who won. because we won the podcast award.
You did.
And I understand we're eligible again this year.
You are eligible, yes. That's perfectly true. And I have to say, you were a very popular win last year as well.
So if anyone listening wants to vote for any of the competitors, or maybe vote for us as best podcast if they want to, where can they go to do so?
Go to the website www.skeptic.org.uk. Have your say, because this is all about the UK skepticism scene, and as we know, this isn't just about the UK, this is about worldwide. These podcasts, the blogs, the events, all of these things, they make a difference, and they come from all over the world. So get on there, tell us who you really like, who's making a difference to you, and we'll be able to shortlist them and get them through to these award ceremonies in April.
We'll put links for you to go and vote, hint hint, on the Podsolution website. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, James.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3 years of archives and find links to vote for us in the Ockham Awards. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. And don't forget, while you're there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Trent Burton, Liz Luckendorf, Andrew Holding, Joe Dunkley, Sean Ellis, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey, Brian Too, and Mark Neal. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.